Good evening, you guys. I'm K2, Sam Amin. K2 Romeo India Whiskey, with a slightly hoarse voice, I don't know why. It's time to begin the TechNet. My name is Dick. You guys have heard me say Saddam many times. What's the purpose of the TechNet? To gather curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment, ham radio, and things of interest to ham radio operators, which sometimes gets into science and space and astronomy and things like that. People sign into the TechNet because they do have a question or a comment. And when they do, they give me their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning they do have a question or a comment. That's approximately the first third of the TechNet, which usually lasts for 4 hours, 8 o'clock to midnight, every Sunday night for the last 36 years, starting in September of 1982. This may be one of the longest running nets in the history of ham radio under essentially one leadership. Longest running in both number of hours and the number of years that it has existed. And maybe the number of people who have signed into it. Let me drop. The second section of the TechNet is run by Roy, AC2GS, and Dr. Roy handles what we call Science Talk. So he's got a couple of, he's got quite a number of real good subjects to discuss tonight on science. The third section of the TechNet, if we don't reverse the order, is Paul, WS2N, with the Space Report, telling us what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and all the other space agencies around the world, what they're doing. And there's always exciting things going on there. Okay, so we're going to take check-ins at this time. Vito to BJF, I think, has already checked in, so to speak. Let's hope Vito really does have a question. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. You're going to give a delay between each transmission to wait for the 3 or 4 beeps. If you don't, you might get timed out. So those who want to check into the TechNet, give me a call letters and name right now after the beeps. K2RIW listening.
This is KD2NHA. I'll be standing by listening. My name is Frank.
Frank, you're checking in because you do have a question or a comment?
No, I'm sorry. I'll be standing by, though, listening to the conversations and enjoying the show. Thank you.
Okay, Frank. Do we have any real check-ins with people who do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
WA2ORY Joe, yes.
WA2 Victor David Henry John, yes.
Okay, we got Joe, who didn't wait for the beeps, and John, who did. So far, we've got Vito, maybe, Joe, and John, for sure. Anyone else to check into the TechNet, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. Okay, maybe we've got more than enough. We heard Vito's voice earlier. Haven't heard from Vito with a real question or a comment for some time. Let's see if Vito's got something to say. WA2PJF. Go right ahead, Vito, if you want to. K2RIW.
Yes, thank you, Dick. WA2PJF. I have nothing in particular. I was just hoping my microphone or my transmitter is still working. I don't operate that much. But however, I don't want to gum things up, but I was just curious about something I was going to ask in the past. I'm very much into the vintage radio equipment and the spark gap transmitters and so forth of the turn of the century. I do a lot of reading on the topic. And I was curious about the flat top antennas that were used in this day. Let me drop. We have, for example, I have a dipole, of course, with your coax cable, and the shield is one half, and the center conductor is the other half of the total length of about 66 feet of this dipole. From my research and looking at different diagrams and so forth, the antennas of that time, like was used at ARRL or aboard, I can't talk anymore, the Titanic, for example, had four conductors, four legs, and then two cables going up. And I was curious, just real quick, it's not really necessary to answer fully, if a piece of coax was used and it was opened up and the sheath went to one of these full length, I'd say 66 feet long wire, and the extended conductor to the other one, and then a second coax, the same scenario, but with a knife switch or a TR switch below, which would transmit from two wires used for receiving and two are used for transmitting. Let me drop. This is a crazy experiment. It's very costly and time-consuming to build such a thing. But would you think that would work today, either as a 40-meter dipole, or it's something that's passe, if I may? Back to you, Dick.
I may be wrong, but I used to think that the flat-top antennas that were popular at that time were really a vertical monopole with a large capacitor on the top, because they were operating at such low frequencies and they didn't have towers that were tall enough to be a quarter wavelength long. That's one way of making the antenna electrically longer, a big flat-top capacitor. And I thought it was fed at the base. Now you're describing that the vertical portion of this flat-top antenna, I think you said, has two coaxial cables side by side, and where the center conductors go and what is being switched, that's not quite clear to me. Were they going to the top hat as a sort of a dipole? I kind of thought not. I thought the top hat was one continuous piece of wire from the north side to the south side, so to speak, with the vertical portion being in the middle. That's what I thought the flat top antenna was. So give me a little bit more description of the coax cable, the two of them with the switch, and how they were being used. Over to you, Vito, W2PJF, K2RIW.
Okay, very good, Dick, WA2PJF. From my studies of the diagrams and circuits and so forth laid out, for example, yes, you're correct. Let's just say, for argument's sake, the four wires are 66 feet long. They're much longer than that, of course. The reason they're much longer, as we all know, is that in those days, the communications took place on the very low band, very low frequencies, 200 meters, 300 meters, and 400 meters, and etc. And the wires were very lengthy. But they were fed at the center, and from what I can see from the diagrams, whether they were coax cable or something similar of that day, let me drop.
Now, the vertical wires going from the ground up, are there four of them, or were they really two coax cables, or is it two pieces of open wire line? Why four? I'm a little confused about that. Or are you saying the top hat wires, there were four of those, and were all four of those continuous from the north side to the south side, so to speak, with the support in the middle, or the supports at the end, but the vertical portion in the middle? So the wiring of four wires. When you talk of four wires, you're talking about the top hat, or you're talking about the vertical things going from the ground up to the antenna? Over to you, Vito, K2RIW.
The top hat, the four conductors were on top, they were horizontal, and the two pieces of cable, were vertical, coming up from the radio room up to the cables, and they were split, and one half of this cable would go to one of the conductors and the other half would go to the other one. And then the same on the other side, and supported on both ends by whatever. Now, the thing I'm saying is that two are used for transmitting and two are used for receiving. And I was just curious in that day, and of course, the length was very long, they were, because of the frequency. And I was just curious if such a thing would still work today, and a knife switch actually was used below to go from transmit to receive. And from what I saw, pictorials and diagrams and so forth, this is what I'm making out of all this. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Vito, the four wires on top that were horizontal, parallel to the ground, were the four wires continuous, or were they broken in the center? And if they're broken in the center, the transmission lines coming up from the ground, how were they wired? Were they wired in a dipole-like manner to the four transmission lines? And were the four transmission lines coax or open wire lines? So the wiring of the four wires on the top, The words you've given me so far have not made that clear, Vito. Over to you, Vito. Mr. PJF, K2IW.
Okay, if you can visualize the flat top antenna, that's the name it was called in this day, and visualize two vertical poles, okay, 100 feet up on either side, for argument's sake, 100 feet apart, make it simple. Four legs, four pieces of wire that were connected with a cross piece of wood on each end, and it was 1, 2, 3, 4, and the same on the other side. They were going from one side to the other. So it was four wires suspended in the air to a piece of wood. We use wood, I guess, because it has to be an insulator. Then it was tied with a whatever to the pole on each end. You can visualize that. But my point is that the diagrams I saw did not show lateral lines or open conductors. It showed one piece of cable. And then the piece of cable, when it was shown at the connection point on both ends at the knife switch, which was a double pole, double throw switch, and the same up above. And it was soldered at the center of this conductor. So it's a, let's say it's a piece of copper, 100 feet long at the 50 foot mark. Let me drop. At the 50 foot mark, it was soldered to that piece of wire. And so you had all four connections in a row at the halfway point. Do you visualize what I'm saying? At the very bottom, it went two went down to the knife switch on one side and two to the other. That's how it functioned. I believe the transmitter was in the center, or the equipment was in the center, if I'm correct in saying. No, I'm trying to think. I'm trying to visualize this, how it was. Whether the antenna was at the center or the receiver and transmitter were on either end, I don't remember the diagram, but something to that scenario. Go ahead.
After two vertical supports with the pieces of wood, each piece of wood has got four parallel wires. Let's say you got a support on the north side with a piece of wood and four wires going to it, and a support on the south side, 100 feet away in your example, the horizontal piece of wood and four wires going to it. The four wires from the piece of wood on the south each went to the piece of wood on the north. Were each of the four wires continuous, or were they broken in the center? That's question number one. Question number two, if I understand correctly, at the 50-foot point, you've got two coaxial cables going up there. Was the center conductor and the shield going to wire number one and wire number two? Was the coax cable number two, shield and center conductor, going to wire number three and wire number four? So were the four wires continuous across the 100-foot gap, or were they broken in the center in some way dipole-like? That's not clear right now. Over to you, Vito, K2LIW.
Okay, it was continuous, unbroken, but as you say, correct. It was joined the way you just said it, exactly. And it was soldered. If they were open copper, for argument's sake, then they just soldered the wire, wrapped around, and soldered, as you said, as you mentioned, 1, 2, 1, 2, just as you said. But the cable, the wire, the antenna itself was unbroken. The antennas, the wires are horizontal, and so are the two pieces of wood in each end. It looks like a hammock. You know a hammock when you go laying in a hammock? Where you have the four ropes or the three ropes, and it goes to a cross piece of wood, and then one rope goes to the tree that holds the hammock up. That's how it looks, Richard. Go ahead. I hate hope tying everybody up with the silliness. Back to you, Richard.
KD2FIU, George.
Stop worrying, Vito. It's not silliness. We're trying to understand an antenna. Now, coax cable number one going up there. We'll say the shield is connected to wire number one, and the center conductor is connected to wire number two. Coax cable number two coming up vertical, is the shield connected to wire number three, and the center conductor connected to wire number four. Of those two coax cables coming down, was one dedicated to the receiver, and one of those coax cables dedicated to the transmitter. If there's a knife switch at the bottom, what is the knife switch doing when you've already got one vertical cable dedicated to receiver and one vertical coax cable dedicated to transmitter? So, you first, Vito. What's going on? Why do you need a knife switch. Over to you, Vito. K2RIW.
Okay, I'm trying to visualize. I saw this a few months ago. Yes, two conductors go for the receiver and two for the transmitter, one on each side of the knife switch. That's a TR switch, so to speak. I'm trying to remember the center. Oh, good golly, I'm trying to remember the center. The transmitter and the receiver have to be tied to those antennas. I have to go look at the diagram again. I remember distinctly seeing a knife switch, distinctly, but I don't remember how it was set up exactly. I have to go through it. When I find this information, what I'm going to do, I don't got to tie anybody up with this anymore now. Other people have more important questions. I'm going to send you in the mail what I come up with, what I found, and you can look at it for yourself, and then I'm going to re-look at the knife switch and see what I saw. Richard, go ahead.
Now, maybe George is familiar with this antenna, and he's going to give us a more clear diagram. You've got it, George.
Thank you, Dick. KD2FRU, George, and good evening. And I'm listening to this, and Vito, please, if you have anything in email of the pictorial of this schematic of this antenna, whatever, please email it to me. I'll give you my email address. I got things that I'm thinking about here is whether they were going for a transmitter and receive antenna and switching between it, and against what was ground at the time. Most antennas at the turn of the 20th century were in Marconi design against ground. So if anything you could send to me about this, any little picture or something, I'm going to really run into it good. Dick, back over to you, and I'll give Vito my email.
George, give us a couple of words on what is a Marconi antenna. Is it a vertical quarter wave monopole operating against ground with the horizontal wires at the top, or really a top hat capacitor? What is a Marconi antenna? Over to you, George.
Quarter wave, half wave, 5/8 wave, up to 3/4, but never full wave. And the transmitter is spiked in the ground, and the antenna is spiked in the ground, and you're looking for 50 ohms between that other leg using earth.
How is the Marconi antenna wired? Is it a vertical monopole with a top hat capacitor operating against ground? Over to you, George.
Original Marconi design, of course, was with a kite using going down into the lowest frequencies possible at the time. Keep in mind, they were resonating, I believe, around 600 hertz, or 1200 hertz, 1800 hertz, not megahertz. And but that has nothing to do with it. The concept is that you're using earth, spiking the transmitter one leg into the ground and spiking the antenna one leg into the ground, using earth for continuity to get your match, and then spiking the other leg in the air. But I'm asking Vito, I want to see this design because I want to really look at this, and I'll give you some good ideas, guys. If he can get it to me, I'll come back next week with some more information about it.
Okay. We know we've seen pictures of these things, but we don't know how they were wired. And we'll eventually find that out. And there's a zillion ways to make and wire antennas. So we'll eventually figure this out. We're going to go to the next person, Joe, to B2LYY. What would you like to discuss tonight, Joe? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, real quick, I apologize, Dick. What's George's call sign?
George is going to give us call sign and email address. He's going to give us everything. You got it, George.
Hi, Vito. KD2FIU, Fox. India uniform, email it to me at radiofever@att.net.
Okay, Radio Fever at ATT.net. Thank you.
Okay, Joe, you've got it.
Okay, this is rather uncomplicated question. Maybe it is complicated, okay. Assuming you're using an FM receiver of commercial quality, and you did some testing on it, but not complete testing. The receiver, say, does a half a microvolt for 20 dB quieting, and say it does about 0.35 for 12 dB sine add. You self-disqualify from the receiver to about 0.25 microvolts, so a carrier above that level will trip the receiver. Now, assuming somebody talking into that receiver has had their radio set up properly with instrumentation so they're not over-deviating and it wasn't set up by somebody's tuned ear, assuming what would cause the squelch to close occasionally on that type of receiver? Assuming also it's a carrier squelch operation, no PL involved. Back to you.
If I plot the response of the IF strip of a receiver, and I think the IF strip is set up for FM demodulation, and I think the IF strip is, let me pick a number, a total of 10 kilohertz wide with a brick wall skirt selectivity, 5 kc up and 5 kc down from center, and the response across the 10 kc is completely flat. That would be an ideal alignment of an IF strip. Very few IF strips are set up that way. If you carefully plot the performance of an IF strip that, in my example, would be 10 kilohertz wide, set up for plus or minus 5 kc of instantaneous deviation, you'll quite often find it's either a Gaussian-shaped response curve or a mu-shaped response curve. There might be a dip in the center. So rarely are they flat. A perfectly operating FM transmitter at every instant of time puts out the exact same amount of power, and the carrier is being swept up and down with the peaks and valleys of the audio. The positive and negative volts of the audio is sweeping the carrier up and down. And so in that case, there would be no change in squelch sensitivity. Well, I can see a slight difference now. As you do create plus or minus 5 kc of deviation, if that's what you're doing, you are creating additional side lobes that fall out of the 10 kHz bandwidth. There are some upper side lobes and lower side lobes. So by way of the Bessel function curves that you can see in the reference data for radio engineers, when you FM modulate, you are putting some of your energy into those side lobes, and some of those side lobes are falling out of that waveform of that IF strip. So that's a possible explanation. So non-flat top and slight over-deviation.
Repeater, timeout.
Slight over-deviation, particularly when you include the PL tone as well as the audio. And I'm listening to myself out of 375. And 375 sounds a little bit weak tonight. Maybe it's just me. So those are the possible explanations, Joe. What's your guess? When the transmitter is deviated, was it being deviated by a pure sine wave or speech? I mean, speech itself has, on average, a 22 dB or something like that crest factor. In other words, the instantaneous peaks of human speech, something like 20 dB louder than the average sine wave power of human speech. So depending on the quality of the speech clipper that you're using on your FM transmitter, depending on how hard is its response, some of those instantaneous peaks of the speech could walk out of the passband. That's another possibility. So there's a lot of possibilities that can be going on here. A hell of a lot of testing would be required to really find out in your particular situation with that particular receiver and that particular transmitter and that particular human voice speaking into that transmitter, what's really going on. A bunch of guesses on my part, as you can tell, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y after waiting for some beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, I'm not sure if you directly answered the question that I had at hand, and that was, why does the squelch close on voice peaks? And assuming you test another receiver and find that one doesn't do the same thing. So one does and one doesn't. But when it does do it on the one particular receiver, what is causing the squelch to actually close? Because the carrier level isn't changing, even though you have dips in the center, depending on the exact amount of modulation level and frequency. But what do you think is causing the squelch to actually close or clip from time to time?
Most of the squelch circuits that we use really contain the output of the discriminator going into a high-pass filter. The high-pass filter is there because a long time ago it was learned that as the carrier gets weaker into an FM discriminator, the high-frequency hiss increases. So the squelch circuit is measuring the amount of high-frequency hiss. When it sees greater high-frequency hiss, it says, aha, that carrier has gotten weaker, I'm going to close the squelch. Or at least I'm going to produce a larger squelch voltage that might close it. So that squelch circuit thinks it's seeing high-frequency hiss. The high-frequency hiss could possibly be on the transmitter itself, rare, but it can happen. The high-frequency hiss could be happening because the discriminator thinks the carrier of the FM transmitter has gotten weaker, and some of that could be the passband response of the IF strip of that receiver. Some of those IF strips have got a slant or a dip in the center or a peak in the center. If it had a peak in the center and with dead audio carrier and the carrier is going into the center where the peak is pleasant, the IF strip's getting a nice strong signal, and then because the IF strip is aligned in a Gaussian-shaped manner, as the signal is deviating, it's now walking down the skirts, the sides of that Gaussian shape. So the shape of the filter is a factor. Over to you, Joe, W2RYY, KQRIW.
Okay, well, I'm working on some commercial receivers in the past. I have come across this, especially with specific types of commercial radios, either portables or fixed receivers, and I have noticed this from time to time. And I have found a quick way of checking that, to find that without sweeping the IF, if the actual band pass is really correct or not. Would you like to hear that method?
Yeah, give us some words on that one, Joe.
Okay. From using some commercial receivers that are actually going back to the late 60s and 70s, there was a procedure in one of the books for, say, some of the General Electric series of receivers. I've used the same procedure on other makes receivers, and it seems to actually do the same thing. It tells you the same thing. And what that is a test for what they call minimum modulation acceptance test. Now, would you like to hear how it works?
That's what I thought you were about to tell us.
Okay. Well, it works like this. You put a signal in 3.3 kilohertz on a normal 5 kilohertz deviation receiver set up to work in that area at a normal bandwidth, not narrow bandwidth, just wide band by today's standards, because there is two different modes being used currently. So, say on a 5 kilohertz plus or minus deviation receiver, you put a signal in and determine what your 12 dB sine add point is. Typically on a 0.5 microvolt receiver, they tell you you're going to get about 0.35 or better for 12 dB sine add. So once you determine that level, you now increase your generator level by 6 decibels higher. So once you do that, and it then says to in the procedure, you increase your deviation slowly until you reach the 12 dB sine add point again. And at that point, the receiver should give you somewhere around 7.5 kilohertz reading on your service monitor when you hit that 12 dB sine add point. That's called your minimum modulation acceptance level. And if you don't check that on receivers, exactly what I described before about this squelch popping on somebody who's like, just hits the receiver below the 20 dB point, that can happen quite frequently. So if you don't check that and just check the 12 dB sine add level and 20 dB quantity level, you can have that happen. So you think that's a good procedure?
Because it was recommended by Motorola or other people, quite possibly it was reasonably well studied, reasonably well used, had a good track record, and it sounds like a pretty good procedure. And in order to pass that procedure, That IF strip has to be properly tuned, flat enough, wide enough. Discriminator has to be doing a good job. The audio has to have low enough distortion, because that's Sinead test. You can fail a Sinead test because not getting enough carrier-to-noise ratio into the IF strip. The IF strip is not wide enough. The modulation is too wide, and so on. There's a whole bunch of ways that you can fail the Sinead test. And if the audio, for some reason, is producing a sine wave, a 1 kilohertz sine wave, which I think is usually injected onto the transmitter during a Sinead test, if the 1 kilohertz sine wave coming out of the discriminator is not a pure sine wave, if it's got flat topping to it, if it's got crossover distortion, if it's got any kind of non-sinusoidal waveform, it will be making harmonics. What the Sinead meter is doing is it is looking at the amount of noise that's left over in the discriminator output after the 1 kilohertz signal has been nulled. So 1.00 kilohertz is being nulled in the Sinead meter, and everything left over is considered noise and distortion. And if that noise and distortion goes above a certain level, the meter tells you a lower Sinead number, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Joe. K2LIW on the TechNet. By the way, I should have mentioned that the Sinead meter first looks at the amplitude of the 1 kilohertz signal, sets that as a reference. Then a later stage nulls out the 1 kilohertz signal and looking at all the noise and distortion products, second harmonic, 2KC, 3KC, third harmonic, looks at everything left over and evaluates everything left over, and the ratio between the 1 kilohertz amplitude and everything left over, that'd be 20 dB or greater, otherwise you fail that test. Okay, Joe, K2LIW. I said 20 dB, it should have been 12, but you know what I mean.
Okay, in the past piece of what you just said, I think you answered my question, and I should have realized this maybe earlier, but it makes a lot of sense now. If the receiver's not symmetrical in its IF symmetry, up to a certain, past a certain point, if it's just not symmetrical, it won't pass high enough amount of deviation, because I've typically seen this in some receivers that are bad. They'll pass the Sinead test, but they won't pass the modulation acceptance, where you can actually put maybe 4.5 kilohertz of deviation in, and it starts to clip in the radio. And what I should have realized, what you just said makes a lot of sense now. You're creating a lot, since you're clipping the audio, you're creating a lot of harmonics, and harmonics are turning into high frequency energy that the squelch is looking at, thinking that the carrier is actually less than more. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're making progress on this one. So a good FM receiver has an IF strip of some given width, maybe 10 kilohertz wide total. It's got a flat top response of that IF strip before the signal gets strong enough to get into heavy limiting. To do that test, you have to be putting in a signal that's weak enough while you're sweeping that receiver so that you're not looking at limiting action. When you're getting limiting action, you get a false response of flatness that may not really be there. And the IF strip goes into the discriminator. The discriminator better have a straight line performance of instantaneous frequency in versus voltage coming out. It's usually a 45-degree line on the right kind of oscilloscope display. That line better be straight so you're not creating distortion. And low harmonic content of the... So it requires linearity of the audio system, linearity of the discriminator, flatness of the... Of the IF strip performance. All of that's got to be working just right to really get a high performance FM receiver. And some of the FM receivers we get in our tiny little radios that we use, Baofengs and Waxons and whatever, sometimes the audio coming out of the loudspeaker is pretty tinny, either because of speaker size, audio linearity, or whatever. When I look at the audio coming out of my IC2AT with a slightly larger loudspeaker, versus what I get out of these little modern-day $30 radios, I'm sometimes quite disappointed at the quality of the audio that I'm getting. Okay, good luck with that, Joe. John was the next person who signed in. WA2, Victor Delta Hotel, I think it is. If I read my writing correctly. K2RW, you got it, John.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Say good evening to everybody on the net. Good evening, Dick. My question has to do with waveguide around cutoff. I was doing a little experiment. I took about an 8-inch piece of WR90 waveguide. At one end, I put a coax to waveguide transition piece to hook up to a sweep generator. And at the other end, I had one of these detector mounts that had a 1N21 diode detector in it. And I hooked it up to a sweep generator. I was using an HP 8350 sweep generator with an 83545 plug-in that sweeps from 5.7 to 12.4. And I set it to sweep from 6 to 9. I wanted to sweep over the cutoff frequency of WR90. I think that's around 6.5 gig, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, so I set up the regular sweep setup, the output of the detector going into the vertical of the scope of... Let me drop. You know, the sweep voltage controlling the horizontal of the scope and everything. And I set it about plus 13 dBm level coming into there. And I saw what I expected, that around 6.5 gig, the output of the diode detector, it was a 1N21 diode, incidentally, the output of the diode jumped up, and below 6.5, I got no output at all from the diode. What I found curious, though, and I'm not sure what was causing it, it may be due to reflections, but what I saw is when the guide started propagating, the response wasn't flat. There was a ripple, like there was maybe an interference pattern going on. Maybe something was being reflected out of the diode detector and causing interference, but there was like a scallop, like almost like a ringing response within the passband of the guide. I was using about an 8-inch piece of WR90, so I just wondering what your thoughts were on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, when you guessed that it was VisWAS caused, you're absolutely right. Assuming that the sweep generator has a built-in leveling circuit and that the power output of the sweep generator is flat. And by the way, sometimes the detector circuit... Oh yeah, there's something I should have told you here. As you start adjusting the signal generator to plus 13 dBm, you're getting very close to 0 dB on the output attenuator of the signal generator, the sweep generator. So the real oscillator inside the sweep generator, it has an output standing wave ratio that's far from ideal. If you had set it for, say, 0 dBm of output, where you're now getting something like 13 dB of attenuation in the output attenuator of the signal generator, that would have corrected the VisWAR on the transmitting side. That would be the equivalent of putting in a 13 dB pad, so to speak. Now, the diode detector, when you read the specs on the diode detector across the frequency region where it's rated to be used, it is far from a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. I'm guessing it's a 1.3 or something like that. So your output detector also has VisWAR. So when you get VisWAR in the output of the waveguide and VisWAR in the input, that means you've got reflections on both sides and the signal is bouncing back and forth. If you had enough sensitivity of your 1N21 detector, let me drop. And there's ways you can get more detection sensitivity there. If you're using a kind of circuit where the diode detector is going into something that's providing bias current, 20 microamps or some crazy number like that of current going into the diode, you get much greater sensitivity out of the diode, in which case you could use it all the way down to like minus 20 dBm into the diode and still see something on the oscilloscope. So by using padding on the output going into the crystal detector, by using a bias network that puts current into the 1N21 to give it greater sensitivity at the low end, and by using attenuation out of the output signal generator, when you finally make the standing wave ratio on the output and the input of the waveguide, and you're sure you're getting good flat leveling out of the signal generator, all of that ripple that you see will go away. The final, what you will see then is that you'll get a very sharp rise at something like 6.5 kilohertz, which is the low frequency cutoff of the waveguide. Let me drop. By the way, a piece of waveguide is the most beautiful, perfect high-pass filter in the world. It's got an extremely sharp cutoff on the low end. A high end does not have a sharp cutoff. As you go to higher frequencies than it's rated, I mean, a piece of W190 is rated to be used at 8 to 12 gigahertz. And below 8 gigs, all the way down to 6.5, it still keeps working. Above 12, you're about to ask what happens, and it'll keep working all the way up to 20 gigahertz if you've got the right kind of a detector circuit. It'll look flat from, let me pick a number, 7 to 20 gigahertz. It'll look flat. The waveguide itself is capable of propagating higher order waveguide modes above something like 14 gigahertz is where it starts having the capability, depending on how you're launching that signal. The signal could going down there. If you really study what's going on, the signal you're putting into the waveguide, into its designed frequency region, let me drop. Assuming the waveguide is laying flat on the table, with the broad wall flat on the table, that signal you're putting in is a vertically polarized signal that is bouncing back and forth, left and right, bouncing off the narrow walls of the waveguide. And for each frequency you put in, there's an exact angle of bounce on each one of those bounces, and no other angle is allowed. It's just the magic of how it works. That angle, by the way, becomes a perfect right angle, because the signal bounces back and forth and doesn't propagate forward at all at 6.5 gigs and below. That's the reason why it's got such a sharp cutoff. That angle goes to 90 degrees. But as you go to higher and higher frequencies, that angle becomes more and more shallow. Eventually, when you look down the waveguide with your eye, you're looking at it at an optical frequency. You could say the angle goes to 0 degrees as you go to higher and higher frequencies. And so you'll see essentially no cutoff at the high frequencies, but this ripple you're seeing is Bismarck caused. And by the way, every piece of waveguide that's used as a resonator, every quarter wave cavity, for instance, really is a piece of transmission line with a short circuit at one end and an open circuit at the other end, if it's a quarter wave reentrant resonating rod. So every waveguide, every coaxial cavity really is a transmission line with a high Biswa and the signal bouncing back and forth. You're seeing minor signals bouncing back and forth because of the Biswa at each end of what you were doing. Over to you on that, John. To B2VDH, K2LIW in TechNet.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Yeah, I really appreciate that. Yeah, I guess the way really to do this experiment, I have to look around. There's a whole box of waveguide components I found over at the school there. So I guess the way really to do this would be maybe to put a circulator there going into the detector so that anything reflected out of the detector, I would put that into a termination. So it wouldn't cause any visual with the incoming signal. Also, the detector mount, I'm sure you've seen this, has a tuning plunger on it. And I've seen as I adjust that plunger, I can get a null. That I guess that's when the plunger is like maybe a half guide wave length from the diode itself. But I put that null well outside of the area that I was, the region of frequency I was sweeping over. So I don't think that was causing, but yeah, it does look like it is a type of interference. Go ahead.
If you were doing the test at one frequency at a time as opposed to sweeping it, that plunger on the detector would allow you to lower the standing wave ratio of the diode detector at that frequency you're using. And to get full performance out of the diode detector, there should be a circuit that applies current into that diode. The diode is not just used as a purely passive device. You pour some current into it to forward bias the diode, a few microamps, in which case it'll have a lot more sensitivity for low signal levels going into it. And at the signal levels where the diode is becoming predictable in its performance, it is a so-called square law detector. Every time you do something to double the voltage going into the diode detector when it's being properly biased and used at a low enough level, the voltage coming out will get four times bigger every time you double the voltage going in. Square law. So the square square low detector region goes all the way down to something like minus 20 dBm. Most diode detectors are very linear up to something like minus 20 or minus 10 dBm. And in that linear region, is that where it's linear or square law? Right now, I'm not quite sure. But there's a whole art and science to properly biasing and properly impedance matching the diode detector. And the diode detector, you're between a rock and a hard place to try to make it become a perfect termination across the very wide frequency region. A circulator is one way of doing it. A simple, well-designed attenuator is another way of doing it. You put 10 dB of attenuation in there, by definition, all reflections off that detector will be more than 20 dB down, because the reflected signal would have to get through the attenuator twice. Maybe a 6 dB attenuator would be more than enough. Circulator is a sophisticated way of doing it. But you've even got to worry with a circulator. You read the specs of a...
Repeater, time out.
You read the specs on the circulator. It has a finite VSWR. I mean, the circulator itself might have a 1.2 or 1.3 standing wave ratio at some of the frequencies across the region where you want to use it. It's good, but not perfect. A properly designed resistive attenuator, one that's got a resistive card inside that piece of waveguide, that can be a very flat attenuator. If it's rated for 6 dB, it could be 6 plus or minus a tenth of a dB across the whole frequency region, if it's well designed. And the resistive card that's in there, you'll find out it's got a taper to it. In other words, the signal is being slowly tapered into the card and slowly tapered back out of it. You can get away with anything with transmission lines if you slowly taper the thing that you're doing it. The dummy load that's inside of some of those dummy load transmission line waveguide type things really is a very sharp point. It's like a sharpened pencil made out of a carbon material. And if that pencil has got a long enough length to it and a sharp enough point, you can easily make a dummy load in waveguide that has a reflection coefficient that's 40 or 50 dB down across the whole frequency region. I own a couple of those, instrumentation-type dummy loads. So with smarts, there's ways you can make the system nearly perfect. Over to you, John, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Yeah, thanks very much. I really appreciate your comments. As I said, I came across a whole box of waveguide components that was at the school there where I work, and they have hasn't been used in a while. So I found some stuff to hook up and have a little play, fun time, as it were. So okay, thanks for your comments, Dick. Really appreciate it. Okay, back to you.
Yeah, the waveguide components you probably found were probably 45-degree bends, 90-degree bends, E-plane bends, H-plane bends, high-pass filters, low-pass filters, waveguide to coax adapters, crystal detectors, double slug tuner, single slug tuner. Any waveguide, there's a zillion ways you can... modify that signal going down the waveguide for impedance matching, frequency selecting, bending the wave in the easy bend direction, the hard bend direction, flexible pieces of waveguide. The total number of components in waveguide is really large. Get a hold of a classic book on the subject by Southworth. Southworth is the author. It's a Prentice Hall book, printed around 1940 or so, an oldie but goodie. And inside that Southworth book, if your library has it, you start looking at those diagrams of all the waveguide components and explanations as to how they work. You'll get a lot of information. When you were seeing all these waveguide components in that laboratory, what school were you at, John? Over to you, KQRIW.
Oh, I'm faculty over at SUNY Farmingdale. As a matter of fact, quite a few years ago, we used to have a work-study program with your former company, AIL. We used to have a number of students that would take classes in the morning or work in the afternoon or vice versa. This is going back into the early 80s. Go ahead.
is a RF laboratory, a physics laboratory at SUNY Farmingdale, which still has a number of those components, sweep signal generators and oscilloscopes and whatever, by which you can do waveguide experiments. So that laboratory, thank goodness they've held on to all that equipment and didn't just throw it away, even if they're not using it for an active course right now. Back to you, John.
Yeah, actually, before I started there in 75, there was a microwave course. Over the years, it sort of got pushed away. The only thing that we have there now is a mic transmission line course, which I do most of the transmission line analysis and stuff with Smith charts. But this was a whole box of components that was used in the course quite a few years ago before I got there. Go ahead.
Now, waveguide components are much less used these days. There's 15 different ways of making a transmission line. Waveguide and coax cable were some of the early ones, and open wire lines are some of the very early ones. Nowadays, most circuits are much more miniature on a printed circuit board, and they're used as microstrip. Strip line and microstrip are the transmission lines that are very popular today, and waveguides are becoming much less used, except in certain high-power circuits like radar. Radar transmitters still use waveguide because the microstrip on printed circuit board can't tolerate those kind of power. But when it comes to receiver circuits today, everything is solid state, microstrip, and strip line. Strip line is where you have an upper and lower ground plane and a piece of a conductor in between acting as coax center conductor. Microstrip, where you have nothing but a lower ground plane and a strip above an insulator on top. And so microstrip, and there's also something called a coplanar waveguide. So microstrip-like circuits, coplanar waveguide, strip line and microstrip, and thin line are some very popular transmission lines used today. My guess is in your microwave course, you've probably heard some of those words recently. Is that true, John? KQIW?
There's a lot of waveguide in my world.
We've been using a piece of software, I'm sure you heard of it, called Puff. It's a few years old, but it allows a simulation using a strip line or microstrip type construction, and we're able to build like some of the stub matching circuits and a quarter wave transformer analysis and stuff like that. Using this software, it's very easy to learn. The nice thing about it is that students can get up almost in like one session, as opposed to some of this horribly expensive E&M software out there that take a whole semester to learn. And checking on that, there's a website called, I think it's Microwaves 101, where they give a lot of rules of thumb. Has some very good information there. That's where I learned about the E-plane bend being the easy way that the waveguide bends, and the H-plane bend being the hard way that the waveguide bends. Go ahead.
Yeah, that Microwave 101 course, is that the one that's done by W1 Gigahertz GHZ? Over to you, John.
It's not done by Paul Wade. I've seen his website. No, this is a separate one. They always come on with this little nomical that says we ain't slack, Captain Walker, and they have a lot of rules of thumb for quick analysis of waveguides and microwaves in general. It's a very informative site, and they send me updates every time they get some new information. Go ahead.
Now, some of the pieces of waveguide that Eric has used in the past, particularly when he had an analog transmitter, I imagine some of those were 8-10 inches wide because of the frequencies being used, gold-plated when it comes to the filters. So you had some pretty big chunks of waveguide between that transmitter and that antenna and that wave and the transmission line going up the tower. The total volume in cubic feet of all those pieces of waveguide that were in your place of business were quite significant, weren't they, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW, and the TechNet?
IW, KE2EJ, yeah. They're quite large. Actually, some of the matching P's and those components were... I remember that stuff used to sit up in the ceiling. Most of what's up at World Trade, since most of the stations are UHF, you know, we start down around 500 megs. There's a big hunch of waveguide. Even my mass filter, that makes a transition from hardline to waveguide. And the filter itself is in waveguide form, and then we turn it back into transmission line. My favorite tool is I have this kit called a dent tuning kit. And it works for all the way down to 500 megahertz to all the way up to 20 gigs, actually. It's fun to use, and you just can't make a mistake with it. This kind of ability is dead. But yeah, waveguide is very much a part of my world. And if anybody really wants to get into strip line, there's a number of really wonderful websites that have impedance calculators for microstrip or strip line or strip dZip. Broadside, asymmetrical, you name it. It does all the really hard calculations for you, so, you know, if you're designing something, you'll have to go out of your mind. K2IW, K2J.
There's quite a few jokes told by the old-fashioned microwave engineers of yesteryear about taking a phased array antenna, slot phased array antenna, which looks like a flat sheet of metal with a whole bunch of slots in it. And behind it is a very elaborate waveguide structure, which is a waveguide structure behind it is a bunch of power dividers and hybrids and whatever, taking the one input connector in waveguide, going to this antenna and breaking it up to 16, 32, 64 individual slots. And when it comes to making that antenna behave well, the engineers literally would take a ball peen hammer and dent the pieces of waveguide very skillfully in certain places in order to improve the performance. You've got to be very careful how you do that because the denting can only be done in one direction. You put a dent in the side of a piece of waveguide that squeezes a little bit. To undent it is very difficult. In fact, what they literally would do in some cases is apply pressure to the waveguide in specific places by using a C-clamp and finding out that when you squeeze the waveguide in this particular area, this particular chunk of performance of that antenna improves, and therefore you know to put a dent in that spot. Very similar to what some guys used to do when it comes to a piece of waveguide where they were about to put screws in it to do tuning. They would put a steel BB inside of the waveguide, turn the transmitter on with everything all reconnected, holding a magnet on the outside of the transmission line, the waveguide. You could pull the magnet along the waveguide, which moves the BB on the inside, and you find out the right spot where the presence of the BB improves the performance, and you say, aha, that's the right place to drill a hole and install a screw with a top so that the screw has now...
Repeater, timeout.
Skillfully placed screws in a piece of waveguide can do all kinds of magic for impedance matching. There is a kind of a slide screw tuner that I own, which literally is a piece of waveguide that looks like it's a slotted waveguide for standing wave ratio detection, but there really is a precision probe that goes down that slot inside the waveguide, and the probe itself can be moved vertically to adjust the amount of probe in the guide, and horizontally to decide how far down the guide between the beginning and the end is it located. And you put that probe of the right length in the right position, no matter how bad your standing wave ratio is, whatever that follows this circuit, you can always do the tuning to make it perfect. It's hard to believe that one simple stub of the right length, one simple probe of the right length and the right location in a piece of waveguide would, at one frequency, make the standing wave ratio perfect. Kind of hard to believe that at first, but once you've seen it and studied it, it's one of the pieces of magic of waveguide. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call that is a name right now, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2RIW with WB2E.
Okay, your audio is quite low, and you didn't give it to me phonetically. It sounded like Whiskey Bravo 2 Echo Alpha Charlie is what it's